The Mystery of the Blue Train, Agatha Christie. Chapter 22. Monsieur Papopoulos Breakfasts. Monsieur Papopoulos was at breakfast. Opposite him sat his daughter, Zia. There was a knock at the sitting room door, and a chasseur entered with a card, which he brought to Mr. Papopoulos. The latter scrutinized it, raised his eyebrows, and passed it over to his daughter. "Ah," said Monsieur Papopoulos, scratching his left ear thoughtfully, "Hercule Poirot, I wonder now." Father and daughter looked at each other. "I saw him yesterday at the tennis," said Monsieur Papopoulos. "Zia, I hardly like this." "He was very useful to you once," his daughter reminded him. "That is true," acknowledged Monsieur Papopoulos. "Also, he has retired from active work, so I hear." These interchanges between father and daughter had passed in their own language. Now, Monsieur Papopoulos turned to the chasseur and said, in French, "Faites monter ce monsieur." A few minutes later, Hercule Poirot, exquisitely attired and swinging a cane with a jaunty air, entered the room. "My dear Monsieur Papopoulos, my dear Monsieur Poirot, and Mademoiselle Zia," Poirot swept her a long bow. "You will excuse us going on with our breakfast," said Monsieur Papopoulos, pouring himself out another cup of coffee. "Your call is a little early." "It is scandalous," said Poirot, "but you see, I am pressed." "Ah," murmured Monsieur Papopoulos, "you are on an affair, then?" "A very serious affair," said Poirot. "The death of Madame Kettering." "Let me see." Monsieur Papopoulos looked innocently up at the ceiling. "That was the lady who died on the blue train, was it not? I saw mention of it in the papers, but there was no suggestion of foul play." "In the interest of justice," said Poirot, "it was thought best to suppress that fact." There was a pause. "And in what way can I assist you, Monsieur Poirot?" asked the dealer politely. "Voilà," said Poirot, "I shall come to the point." He took from his pocket the same box that he had displayed at Cannes, and opening it, he took out the rubies and pushed them across the table to Papopoulos. Although Poirot was watching him narrowly, not a muscle of the old man's face moved. He took up the jewels and examined them with a kind of detached interest. Then he looked across at the detective inquiringly. "Superb, are they not?" asked Poirot. "Quite excellent," said Monsieur Papopoulos. "How much would you say they're worth?" The Greek's face quivered a little. "Is it really necessary to tell you, Monsieur Poirot?" he asked. "You are shrewd, Monsieur Papopoulos. No, it is not. They are not, for instance, worth $500,000. Papopoulos laughed, and Poirot joined with him. "As an imitation," said Papopoulos, handing them back to Poirot, "they are, as I said, quite excellent. Would it be indiscreet to ask, Monsieur Poirot, where you came across them?" "Not at all," said Poirot. "I have no objection to telling an old friend like yourself. They were in the possession of the Comte de la Roche." Monsieur Papopoulos' eyebrows lifted themselves eloquently. "Indeed," he murmured. Poirot leaned forward and assumed his most innocent and beguiling air. "Monsieur Papopoulos," he said, "I'm going to lay my cards upon the table. The original of these jewels was stolen from Madame Kettering on the blue train. Now I will say to you first this. I am not concerned with the recovery of these jewels. That is the affair of the police. I am not working for the police, but for Monsieur Fanaldin. I want to lay hands on the man who killed Madame Kettering. I am interested in the jewels only insofar as they may lead me to the man. You understand?" The last two words were uttered with great significance. Monsieur Papopoulos, his face quite unmoved, said quietly, "Go on." "It seems to me probable, monsieur, that the jewels will change hands in Nice, may already have done so." "Ah," said Monsieur Papopoulos. He sipped his coffee reflectively, and looked a shade more noble and patriarchal than usual. I say to myself, continued Poirot with animation, what good fortune! My old friend, Monsieur Papopoulos, is at Nice. He will aid me. And how do you think I can aid you? Inquired Monsieur Papopoulos coldly. I said to myself, without doubt, Monsieur Papopoulos is in Nice on business. Not at all, said Monsieur Papopoulos. I am here for my health, by my doctor's orders. He coughed hollowly. I am desolated to hear it, replied Poirot, with somewhat insincere sympathy. But to continue, when a Russian Grand Duke, an Austrian Archduchess, or an Italian Prince wish to dispose of their family jewels, to whom do they go? To Monsieur Papopoulos, is it not? He, who is famous all over the world for the discretion with which he arranges these things. The other bowed. You flatter me. It is a great thing, discretion, mused Poirot, and was rewarded by the fleeting smile which passed across the Greek's face. I, too, can be discreet. The eyes of the two men met. Then Poirot went on speaking very slowly, and obviously picking his words with care. I say to myself this. If these jewels have changed hands in Nice, Monsieur Papopoulos would have heard of it. He has knowledge of all that passes in the jewel world. Ah, said Monsieur Papopoulos, and helped himself to a croissant. The police, you understand, said Monsieur Poirot, do not enter into the matter. It is a personal affair. One hears rumors, admitted Papopoulos cautiously. Such as, prompted Poirot. Is there any reason why I should pass them on? Yes, said Poirot, I think there is. You may remember, Monsieur Papopoulos, that 17 years ago there was a certain article in your hands, left there as security by a very prominent person. It was in your keeping, and it unaccountably disappeared. You were, if I may use the English expression, in the soup. His eyes came gently round to the girl. She had pushed her cup and plate aside, and with both elbows on the table and her chin resting in her hands, was listening eagerly. Still keeping an eye on her, he went on. I'm in Paris at the time. You send for me. You place yourself in my hands. If I restore to you that article, you say I shall earn your undying gratitude. Eh bien, I did restore it to you. A long sigh came from Monsieur Papopoulos. It was the most unpleasant moment of my career, he murmured. 17 years is a long time, said Poirot thoughtfully. But I believe that I am right in saying, monsieur, that your race does not forget. A Greek? Murmured Papopoulos with an ironical smile. It was not as a Greek I meant, said Poirot. There was a silence, and then the old man drew himself up proudly. You are right, Monsieur Poirot, he said quietly. I am a Jew, and as you say, our race does not forget. You will aid me then. As regards the jewels, monsieur, I can do nothing. The old man, as Poirot had just done now, picked his words carefully. I know nothing, I have heard nothing, but I can perhaps do you a good turn, that is, if you are interested in racing. Under certain circumstances I might be, said Poirot, eyeing him steadily. There is a horse running at Longchamp that would, I think, repay attention. I cannot say for certain, you understand. This news passed through so many hands. He stopped, fixing Poirot with his eyes, as though to make sure that the latter was comprehending him. Perfectly, perfectly, said Poirot, nodding. The name of the horse, said Monsieur Papopoulos, leaning back and joining the tips of his fingers together, is the Marquis. I think, but I'm not sure, that it is an English horse. Asia? I think so, too, said the girl. Poirot got up briskly. I thank you, monsieur, he said. It is a great thing to have what the English call a tip from the stable. Au revoir, monsieur, and many thanks. He turned to the girl. Au revoir, Mademoiselle Zia. It seems to me but yesterday that I saw you in Paris. One would say that 2 years had passed at most. There is a difference between 16 and 33, said Zia ruefully. Not in your case, declared Poirot gallantly. You and your father will perhaps dine with me one night. We shall be delighted, replied Zia. Then we will arrange it, declared Poirot. And now, je me sauve. Poirot walked along the street, humming a little tune to himself. He twirled his stick with a jaunty air. Once or twice he smiled to himself quietly. He turned into the first bureau de poste he came to and sent off a telegram. He took some time in wording it, but it was in code, and he had to call upon his memory. It purported to deal with a missing scarf pin, and was addressed to Inspector Japp of Scotland Yard. Decoded, it was short and to the point. Wire me everything known about man whose sobriquet is the Marquis. Chapter 23. A New Theory. It was exactly 11 o'clock when Poirot presented himself at Fenalden's hotel. He found the millionaire alone. You are punctual, Monsieur Poirot, he said with a smile as he rose to greet the detective. I'm always punctual, said Poirot. The exactitude, always do I observe it. Without order and method, he broke off. Ah, but it is possible that I have said these things to you before. Let us come at once to the object of my visit. Your little idea. Yes, my little idea, Poirot smiled. First of all, monsieur, I should like to interview once more the maid, Ada Mason. She is here? Yes, she's here. Ah. Fenalden looked at him curiously. He rang the bell, and a messenger was dispatched to find Mason. Poirot greeted her with his usual politeness, which was never without effect on that particular class. Good afternoon, mademoiselle, he said cheerfully. Be seated, will you not, if monsieur permits? Yes, yes, sit down, my girl, said Fenalden. Thank you, sir, said Mason primly, and she sat down on the extreme edge of a chair. She looked bonier and more acid than ever. I have come to ask you yet more questions, said Poirot. We must get to the bottom of this affair. Always I return to the question of the man in the train. You have been shown the Comte de la Roche. You say that it's possible he was the man, but you are not sure. As I told you, sir, I never saw the gentleman's face. That is what makes it so difficult. Poirot beamed and nodded. Precisely, exactly. I comprehend well the difficulty. Now, mademoiselle, you have been in the service of Madame Catherine 2 months, you say. During that time, how often did you see your master? Mason reflected a minute or two, and then said, Only twice, sir. And was that near to or far away? Well, once, sir, he came to Curzon Street. I was upstairs, and I looked out over the banisters and saw him in the hall below. I was a bit curious-like, you understand, knowing the way things were. Mason finished up with her discreet cough. And the other time, I was in the park, sir, with Annie, one of the housemaids, sir, and she pointed out the master to me, walking with a foreign lady. Again, Poirot nodded. Now listen, Mason. This man, whom you saw in the carriage, talking to your mistress at the Gare de Lyon, how do you know it was not your master? The master, sir. Oh, I don't think it could have been. But you're not sure, Poirot persisted. Well, I never thought of it, sir. Mason was clearly upset at the idea. You've heard that your master was also on the train. What more natural than it should be he who came along the corridor? But the gentleman who was talking to the mistress must have come from outside, sir. He was dressed for the street, in an overcoat and soft hat. Just so, mademoiselle, but reflect a minute. The train had just arrived at the Gare de Lyon. Many of the passengers promenade themselves upon the quay. Your mistress was about to do so, and for that purpose had doubtless put on her fur coat, eh? Yes, sir, agreed Mason. Your master then does the same. The train is heated. but outside, in the station, it is cold. He puts on his overcoat and his hat, and he walks along beside the train, and looking up at the lighted windows, he suddenly sees Madame Kettering. Until then, he has had no idea that she was on the train. Naturally, he mounts the carriage and goes to her compartment. She gives an exclamation of surprise at seeing him, and quickly shuts the door between the two compartments, since it's possible that their conversation may be of a private nature. He leaned back in his chair and watched the suggestion slowly take effect. No one knew better than Hercule Poirot that the class to which Mason belongs cannot be hurried. He must give her time to get rid of her own preconceived ideas. At the end of 3 minutes, she spoke. "Well, of course, sir, it might be so. I never thought of it that way. The master is tall and dark, and just about that build. It was seeing the hat and coat that made me say it was a gentleman from outside. Yes, it might have been the master. I would not like to say either way, I'm sure." "Thank you very much, mademoiselle. I shall not require you any further. Ah, just one more thing." He took from his pocket the cigarette case he'd already shown to Catherine. "Is that your mistress's case?" he said to Mason. "No, sir, it's not the mistress's. At least..." She looked suddenly startled. An idea was clearly working its way to the forefront of her mind. "Yes," said Poirot encouragingly. "I think, sir, I can't be sure, but I think it is a case that the mistress bought to give to the master." "Ah," said Poirot in a noncommittal manner. "But whether she ever did give it to him or not, I can't say, of course." "Precisely," said Poirot, "precisely. That is all, I think, mademoiselle. I wish you good afternoon." Ada Mason retired discreetly, closing the door noiselessly behind her. Poirot looked across at Fenalden, a faint smile upon his face. The millionaire looked thunderstruck. You think it was Derrick?" he queried. "But everything points the other way. Why, the Count has actually been caught red-handed with the jewels on him." "No. But you told me..." "What did I tell you?" "That story about the jewels. You showed them to me." "No." Fenalden stared at him. "You mean to say you didn't show them to me?" "No." "Yesterday at the tennis?" "No." "Are you crazy, Monsieur Poirot, or am I?" "Neither of us is crazy," said the detective. "You ask me a question, I answer it. You say, have I not shown you the jewels yesterday? I reply, no. What I showed you, Monsieur Fenalden, was a first-class imitation, hardly to be distinguished except by an expert from the real ones."